Well, welcome everyone. So I'm Andy Herskowitz. I'm the relatively new executive director of ODI right here in Washington, D.C. For those of you who aren't familiar with ODI, it's been one of the world's leading global affairs think tanks going back to the 1960s in the UK. We have over 200 staff globally and probably a few hundred more of fellows who we reach out to globally as well to work with us on issues. And made a decision to open up an office right here in Washington. So we've had a fantastic day of events already today, and we have a few more events. We hope some of you will stick around for that. But this session is something that I'm particularly excited about. And I want to thank Global Affairs Canada for sponsoring this event with us. I'd like to recognize Cam Doe, who is with Global Affairs Canada, and also Genevieve Brown. And we generated this idea of holding this session. And to Cam's credit, she said, rather than me give some opening remarks, I want to hear from these panelists because you have really incredible people here. And for those of you who've ever been on a panel with me, this isn't going to be your normal panel. There's going to be a lot of discussion and interrupting and challenging with one another because we're here to solve issues. I think one of the reasons that ODI opened up an office here in Washington, D.C. is because ODI's catchphrase is think change, but really what ODI is about is making change as well. And it's critical that we look at some of these issues and we don't just sit on high-level panels and expert working groups, but we actually take it to the next level and we push a lot of the entities that need to make the change to make those changes. And part of that is by using our influence, by writing, by convening, by talking to people, and having a seat in Washington makes all the difference in the world. So really want to thank everyone. I want to thank the ODI team who's here. We have probably about 20 people in town from London, some of the smartest people you'll ever meet in your entire life right now, who work in the development and global affairs space and who are involved in a lot of these expert working groups as well. This particular session, the way I'm going to describe it, is focusing on the hard stuff. I mean, if I had to say it, it's how to reach the underserved boroughs. We hear a lot about how are we going to increase the amount of capital available to the multilateral development banks? How are we going to push DFIs, development finance institutions, to do more? There's a lot of sessions. There are workshops. There are conferences on financing fragility. There are conferences on financing women, conferences on how are we going to reach indigenous groups? What about the least developed countries? We're hearing from voices from all over the world, particularly from the global south, that the development finance architecture, as it was designed at Bretton Woods and subsequently, isn't working for them. Yesterday, I was at an event with the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Motley, and she had some choice quotes, and I didn't write down all of them. Some of them are very critical of the United States. But let me say this. She said, our countries cannot develop on 15-year money with variable interest rates. He said, we need oxygen, finance is oxygen, whether for climate or for the SDGs. Why can't countries just pay low interest rates up front rather than everyone paying lawyers millions of dollars to renegotiate deals later? You know, people need access to money that makes sense so they can borrow, so they can borrow in order to be able to repay. I heard at a panel yesterday from Margaret Kulo from the US Treasury, who emphasized a point you'll often hear from us, that it's not about how much money you're committing or dispersing if you're an MDB or if you're a DFI. It's about what you're achieving. In fact, she the point that she made was, if there's a multilateral development bank that has an opportunity to finance a project and a private bank comes in, they should let it go because they've done their job, because this is public financing. And our goal ultimately is to really put ourselves out of business. So this panel brings together people who I've known, some I've known for a long time, and we've had a lot of conversations, sometimes heated conversations about what works and what doesn't work. To some people, the title didn't really make sense. So we've grouped together a lot of things. I think a lot of people don't distinguish between the public lending for sovereign lending and private lending, but it's a lot of the same issues that we deal with here. And I've classified underserved borrowers, and I'm open to discussion about better ways to describe this for underserved groups, of, you know, those who are living in underserved areas, the least developed countries, the low-income countries who often don't see as many deals, vulnerable areas of countries, you know, fragility. Then you've got a group of people, women, and we've seen a lot of movement to try to do more to finance women. You've seen the initiatives that focus on women's economic empowerment, like the 2X initiative. Underserved people like the LGBTQ community, indigenous people with disabilities, Afro descendants in Latin America, religious minorities, former combatants, youth, elderly, all of these groups who often struggle to get access to financing. And then you've got these underserved classes of borrowers is what I've described them as. But again, I'm open to different ways. But I can tell you that when I was working at the Development Finance Corporation, I'd travel to a lot of countries and you'd meet with market women who they need $500 to $1,000. And the solution always is working through intermediaries. Or how many times I got calls or emails from businesses when I first joined DFC saying, you know, what's going on? I only need $500,000 or $1 million. And I've got all these requirements that I need to meet. And I can't meet those requirements. And people say they won't really work on deals under $5 million, even though DFC will do deals as low as $1 million. But the idea is to dig into these issues a bit and to ask ourselves questions about what are the approaches that are working? How can we scale these approaches? What are the structural challenges that we're facing, sort of at the macro level, and then also, you know, within your institutions? So I'm hoping everyone will speak, you know, very frankly. So what are the cultural issues that you see? You know, one example, when we were at DFC, we worked closely with the Stanford Seed Program. And one of my colleagues met with a lot of the entrepreneurs who said, I own, you know, it in a country and said, I own a house and the local bank wouldn't lend me land because my house isn't in the right neighborhood. Another said, I'm not from the right ethnic group, so they wouldn't lend to me. So we want to have open discussions about what these issues are and what can be done about it. And then most importantly, who are the stakeholders that we need to convince to make the changes? Because I know it's not just the institutions themselves. It's often external stakeholders. It's the shareholders. For the US, it's the US Congress. I know that DFC frequently will issue press releases talking about how much money it's committed or dispersed, knowing that that's not actually the right number to be measuring, but knowing that their stakeholders, whether you're Republicans or Democrats, that's how people externally who don't understand all of the issues related to development finance are going to measure success. So how do we help educate people externally so that we can do the types of things that we need to do? So with that, I'm going to just quickly introduce our panelists and thank them for joining us. We're joined by Adama Mariko, who's the Secretary General of Finance in Common. We have Lori Kerr, who's the CEO of FinDev Canada. Colin Buckley, who's the Managing Director of British International Investment. Agnes Dasavich, who's the Chief Operating Officer and Head of Investments at the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation. Franny Lothier, who's the CEO of the Southbridge Investment. And Cesar Buenadicha, who's the head of the discovery unit at the IDB Lab. And IDB Lab is particularly important. And I'm going to start with you, Cesar. And here's why. When I was at DFC, I frequently would hear about say, we should be doing this, we should be doing that. And people would say, IDB Lab does that. I was on a panel with someone and on Haiti, and it was USAID organized it. How are we going to drive more investment into Haiti? And the person at IDB Lab rattled off about 10 investments under $1 million they were doing in Haiti. And then I heard about a company that had approached us about financing, a tech company. And next thing I know, I read about it that IDB Lab's financing them. So I guess my question to you is what, you know, IDB Lab has been some of the most forward-leaning financing institutions making these types of investments. You know, can you talk about the approaches that IDB Lab takes to facilitate these investments?
Thank you very much, Andrew. Thank you, everyone. Today. Great to be here. Great.
It's better to talk with the microphone, yeah. So thank you. It's an honor to be here. Maybe as IDB Lab and my unit, which is a discovery unit, no? This is not a normal title that you hear in these conferences. What I'm not going to talk about money or, you know, numbers so much. I'm going to talk about innovation in finance, which is very much needed, no? And I want to say like three things, quick ones. No, the first one is the need of technology. And we all know that, no? In Latin America, there are 2,500 fintechs, which are new players in Latin America. We would assume that things are so much better in terms of the underserved population. It's not. And there is also this ethical dilemma, no? So the other day, we approved an operation with a fintech, no? Because the whole thing about providing financial inclusion is about asymmetry of information, no? So what they do right now, the fintechs, is they get into your phone, they look at your apps, and then they do the credit scoring, no? I don't know if we agree with that or not, but that is a very important question that we need to start asking, no? Does the end justify the means? Do we agree that the use of data and algorithms for the underserved population should be the mean, the goal, something that we disregard because it's more important to serve those populations? We have some questions and we have a program around responsible artificial intelligence. And I think this is going to be an increasingly important question because it's not just about serving underserved population. It's about doing it the right way, no? Maybe a second thing I want to discuss, and this is innovation, is
you're taking on technology risk also, which a lot of the DFIs won't take on technology risk. Is that fair statement?
Yeah, but the question is how we understand technology, how we rate technology, how we understand the algorithms, no? And we come with a fintech and they tell us, you know, we can reach underserved population, but we need to have access to the phone of the people and look at the apps they have because that gives us a very much better credit scoring, no? What do we say? Yes, no, maybe? I'm just saying that this is a good question, no? And this is going to be increasingly the norm that we have because many of the underserved populations are going to be having cell phones, no? And it's not about just reaching them through the cell phone. It's using the cell phone as a credit scoring tool, no? So this is something that we are exploring a lot in a program, no? And we invite all of you to keep exploring this, no? The ethical implications of algorithms in reaching underserved populations, no? Maybe a second thing is I was talking about that we are very much into that. As I was telling last week, I was in El Salvador. I used to work there 25 years ago in microfinance. And the women, they were like 45, 40 when I was there. Now they are like 60, 65. What happens with the elderly population? Are we serving those people? Latin America and many parts of the world are aging very fast. What are we going to do with the financial inclusion of the population that is getting older, no?
Okay, so what are we going to do about it? I mean, do you have ideas about what you can do?
Yes. So first thing that
And also, I invite anybody to jump in at any time if you have an answer or you want to ask a question.
I want ideas. Yes. I have questions, but I want ideas.
Okay. All right. We can get back to that. So Agnes, so not everybody knows this, but before you were at DFC, you were at CIF, which did a lot of impact investing and worked in more challenging environments. So what are some of the tools that you thought worked to best reach these underserved borrowers and how's that experience informed your approach to underserved borrowers at DFC?
So as you know, I'm a big fan of intermediaries.
Yes.
Because
and we argue about this. So go ahead. So let's have this conversation.
Well, one, okay. Because Thief was an intermediary that supported more intermediaries, but in general, you know, just going back to some of your earlier comments when you introduced this topic, I mean, the reason that we have a lot of requirements is not necessarily because we'd like to pay a lot of lawyers, but because we are managing taxpayer resources. And we're managing taxpayer resources. Other people are managing investor resources where those investors are trusting them with delivering returns, if not capital preservation. So you kind of have to balance that with how do you actually then make investments into the most vulnerable populations where the greatest need is. And the only way really in my mind to do that is to work through intermediaries, whether fintechs, who are actually now making great inroads into rural populations because they don't have to set up actual retail branches to reach them, all the way to funds, SME funds like CIF and others who are investing in SMEs. But also, you know, banks play an important role, especially as they go digital as well. So I feel like there is an entire ecosystem that needs to be supported as opposed to kind of one solution, because I think it just really depends on the population, the country, the type of capital they're looking for. They're looking for trade capital, or they're looking for working capital, or they're looking for long-term investment because they actually want to invest in something where they'll be manufacturing something small. I mean, the whole point is that it's very transaction dependent. And I feel that intermediaries, first of all, who are in the field, in the communities where the capital is needed, probably have the most chance of success of delivering the right kind of capital at the right time to the right people, because they also know how to assess those risks. For us to be assessing those risks from Washington, D.C. is just really not feasible.
So I don't disagree with you about intermediaries, and I want to actually turn to Lori on this in just a minute. issue that I see, and I have a close friend who does a lot of business in countries all over the world. And I was telling him about a deal that we had just done. And I was so excited about it. And he said, it's terrible. He said, you lend them money, then they lend money to a local cooperative. And then the local cooperative lends money to the farmers. And these farmers are paying 30%. And it's killing them. So my view on this is that intermediaries are often doing the work that you as development agencies are doing, either because you don't have the bandwidth or the capacity to do everything, but you have this pressure to still earn a return. Like, do the DFIs actually need to earn a return on the money they lend to an intermediary? I'm not saying lose money, but if you say we're recognizing that we can't do this ourselves, and we're going to have you do this, and we're going to give you some technical assistance that you don't have to pay back because our ultimate goal is development. Could something like that work? And you can chew on that a little bit. And Colin, I'm going to come to you eventually, but Lori, at FinDev Canada, I think that you've got, and correct me if I'm wrong, I was looking at the website, 70% of your investments are made through financial intermediaries. What do you see as the pros and cons working through intermediaries for reaching underserved groups?
Yeah, thanks, Andy. And I'm going to pick up on some of the things that Agnes said. So indeed, we're balancing out our portfolio a little bit more. FinDev Canada is only 5 years old. So we started in 2018, did a few transactions, and then COVID hit. So the way that we were able to grow as an organization is working with partners. And all of the DFIs pivoted and MDBs pivoted sort of to work with intermediaries to get liquidity to where it's needed most in market. So that's really how we built our book is through intermediary. So we're balancing out that now, but intermediaries are always going to be a very important part of the business for many of the reasons that Agnes said. And I think some of the pros of that are the knowledge of the local markets, right? It's not just knowledge, but it's also like knowledge of, you know, legal regulatory frameworks, et cetera, but it's knowledge of local preferences. And it's also trust, right? Like when some of the intermediaries are interacting with the end borrowers, there's a huge element of trust. And as Agnes said, whether we're in the field or whether we're wherever our headquarters are, you're not able to build those relationships. Yeah. I think it's also a matter of efficiency and effectiveness. So one of the intermediaries that we've supported, El Salvador, Fedecredito in El Salvador, which is a second tier bank, they provided 50,000 loans last year, like more than 50,000 loans.
And are you getting reporting on the data from them? And so that's part of the package they're doing?
Package providing technical assistance to help them along their data journey, help them with their sub borrowers in terms of what is the type of information, a lot of harmonization efforts, because we're not the only DFI that's financing some of these intermediaries. So how can we all harmonize as a group to reduce the burden on them? But certainly technical assistance, the sort of more than money approach is really, really important. But I don't think it's just a matter that some of the DFIs are structured in a way that we have to preserve our capital. And we can get into that in a second, but I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that those local relationships are really, really important. They're going to have the capillarity that we would never have, and able to do the 50,000 loans that we don't do 50,000 loans in a year anyways, but they can do that. So I think that's really, really important. And so you're also building that second, there's sort of a double positive whammy, right? Not only are the sub borrowers getting better products, sort of their needs tended to, but then you're also building that layer of the economy of the intermediation, right? So if we did all of this from headquarters, what are we contributing? We might be contributing money, but we're actually not building that local ecosystem, which is really, really important.
No, I absolutely agree that you need to build that local economy, and you don't want to distort the local market either, which goes back to the original point that Margaret made. Like, you know, all of your jobs are really to put yourselves out of business ultimately. Well, not Franny. not Franny. Yeah. But I mean, that really is what the important, go ahead, Agnes.
Because this is a really important point. And this is why I think technical assistance is needed in a lot of circumstances, but it's not so much about that we need to preserve our capital. It's about the fact
that BSC doesn't have to, you're like uniquely positioned globally.
Right. But what I'm saying is it's important in order for those capital markets to develop, and in order for all of those borrowers, beneficiaries, whatever you want to call them, to actually become part of that system, they need to have repayment. Mm-hmm. So I think just giving grants and technical assistance without the actual tools to help people borrow money or take on investments and pay them back to show that they can, we'll never really open up those capital markets beyond the DFIs.
Your point is that if you give a repayable grant to a local financial institution, that's not going to help them nearly as much if they get a low interest loan.
I've worked with SMEs who said that they have a hard time raising money from private investors because they received grants in the past and they're seen as grant recipients, right? So I think we have to be careful about that.
Franny, do you want to weigh in on this from the other side also as an investor?
Yeah, I was listening to you saying I should work myself out of a job.
No, not you.
No, but the other way around. When I left, I worked in MDBs all my life, and then I decided to go and work fully in the private sector and take risks in asset management and investing. And I said, I know the DFI, so I'm going to go to them and say, here's a great idea. I need financing. Of course, zero came through that process. And I ended up having to put my own retirement funds in order to prove that you can actually do it. So what did we do? Very simply, how do you reach the underserved? We looked at the really tiny companies who make up 90% of the African economy. Say, how can you go to them directly with funding so that you don't have to go through big structures, the banks and so on. And of course, the digital platforms provide that opportunity, but we didn't want to use the data on the digital devices in order to do that. So we found a very great scientist who came up with a psychometric testing model, where you have them play the game on their device. It doesn't have to be a smartphone. And after 5 questions, you know what kind of credit history that person would generate, and you issue their first loan. And it's a very small, low interest.
Did you tell
loan.
Them that why they were playing the game? That they were going.
They know they're playing the game in order to get a loan, and they do know that the way they answer the questions will impact whether they're approved or not. So that is completely disclosed. And the games are very simple, like, you know, you put wood on a fire, you boil the water, but it can't boil over and it can't dry. So how do you strategize around that? And that gives you a lot of psychological information about the kind of borrower they would be, or saver. And through that, we were able to test, and the first credit is a risk because you don't know, right? You're relying on psychometric tests. But then the repayment history gives them the credit history that you need, and then you can scale up the loans. So with this, we could go directly to the smallest borrower, $100, maximum $10,000. And we now have issued over 80,000 loans, created more than 10,000 jobs, supported more than 6,000 unique companies, and it's growing. But I had to use my own retirement funds to put my future retirement at risk to do that. But now it's working. And you go to DFIs, and the first DFI said, you know, I love this, but I can't give you a loan. I can give you a grant, and you can't give me the money back, but you can use it to invest. So he said, okay, we can do that. So we're investing the grant, and the returns from that are then recycled and invested again. And that DFI just wants the impact, how many jobs, how many unique companies supported, and so on. But it was very difficult to get a loan. Then we said, okay, now let's apply to something else. You can do it for reforestation, maybe e-mobility. And guess who complained? The IFC, saying, well, you are competing with us. I said, but that's the whole point.
Right.
If we are competing with you, you should move out of the space,
exactly,
because it proves that the private sector can do it. So I think the DFIs have a bit of a challenge. They come in too late when everything is de-risked, or when they find that the private sector can do it, they say that that's their business model. So I think this is maybe, I'm being a bit harsh,
no,
my friends at IFC and the World Bank, but I see a lot of colleagues here saying that that's the experience.
No, I could share lots of stories. I probably will, depending on how much time we have.
And then the second area, I think, let me say now what has worked, because this first one is a criticism. What has worked? We've found actually philanthropy are very comfortable to come in if the DFI comes next. And we have 3 philanthropists who are able to give us startup capital. So they pay up 2 years of management fees, which you use to structure the vehicle, to develop the pipeline, to build capacity where you need it for impact tracking and so on. And then sometimes they can come in with a first loss piece or some other support for the early years. But then after that, you actually generate returns and you no longer need to go there again. And then the last one, which we innovated particularly at Southbridge Investments, which is what we call a give once model. Because if you take a typical DFI with grant money, every dollar given in grant is a dollar for return. What we've managed to do is to structure it in a way that a portion of that dollar, let's say 5 cents, goes towards de-risking capital raised in the markets. So you have already the market test because those funds have to be paid back with a return. But it allows the 95 cents to then go towards the traditional technical assistance, pipeline development, and so on. And this way, the 5 cents you take only once from each dollar. You never need to go back again because you can recycle that. And so it's like a repayable grant, but it's not repaid to the donor. It's repaid to the community that you're trying to impact. And with this, we can go to the very difficult to reach areas for energy access like Niger, Burkina Faso, and so on. You can go to the smallest individual company with small little needs like $100. We aggregate micro assets based on that. And then finally, you can take risk in areas that have very long-term returns, for instance, carbon markets, because nobody will take a risk in a market that hasn't fully developed from the private sector. So these ways of working with philanthropy and grant makers allows you to actually tap into huge liquidity in the private markets, but do it in a smart way that reaches the very people that if we can't reach with financing today, 20, 30, 60 years from now, we are still having this conversation. So we decided just, you know, I just said, I'll put my retirement.
Oh, that's great. One of the reasons I really wanted Agnes on this, because she and I will have these discussions again and again. And I like what she said. I'm not completely sold on it. I was sold on it when you said it, but then I've been thinking about it. I've been sitting here also. So this is what I wanted to have these conversations about. Because look, the reality is, if you ask a bank, do you want a grant or do you want, you know, or a few million dollars a loan, who's going to say, oh no, I really want that loan. So I'm sorry, but they would rather get it. And I'm not talking about giving them a grant that's not repayable. I'm talking about giving them a low interest loan or an at cost loan. And that's what I'm really
talking about. But that's still a loan.
Yeah, it's a loan. I'm never talking about giving. I am talking about giving grants for technical assistance and things like that. That's fine.
No one. A repayable grant is just a 0% loan.
Yeah, I think there's too many repayable grants. Like
that's
just,
what I'm saying. Just a 0%
loan. Right. Totally. We're on the same page. But this is. I was going to turn to Adama on this because you work with the public development banks and represent. How many of them are going to complain about a grant or a zero cost loan from a larger agency? Because I say that we all are working or the DFI should be working to put themselves out of business. Franny should not be working to put herself out of business. You should have a longer timeline because you're working with the public development banks and national development banks. And eventually they should be taking over as the next stage. And we shouldn't need regional development banks and international development banks and bilateral development banks. Because if we do, we talk about localization all the time in the aid world, but really this is aid. It's just aid in the form of financing. So isn't true localization strengthening the local institutions? What perspectives can you offer based on what you've heard from people so far?
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I'll come on the loan and grant afterwards. But first of all, just to give the scope of what we call public development banks, actually, because often we see these, you know, DFI activity looking at banks that have international activity, obviously. But that's just only 10% of the banks that exist in the world, public development banks, I mean. We have counted so far through research that we have 530 public development banks in the world. And even in US, you have some, I mean, there is DFC, obviously, but actually in the national area also. But you know, 90% of those banks work on their country for their only shareholder, which is the country itself. I work for AFD, the French Development Agency. In France, you have Caisse des Dépôts, which is the oldest development bank in the world, more than 200 years. But if you look at in other countries, and I have discovered it recently, in Ethiopia, they have a bank that is more than 100 years, actually. And that's something we see going and going. After 2008, you have the existing amount of banks in the world,
20% of them was created after the 2008 crisis. And that's also a pattern where we see that the countries, you know, seeing their fiscal area narrowing, actually they count also on their public development banks in structuring their economies. The concentration of the balance sheet is also something we should look at. If you take the G20 countries, if you they concentrate the 80% of the total asset of those public development banks in the world. That means also the contribution those banks had in their national economy, first of all, but also the contribution they had on what is the economy today. I mean, the carbonation issue should be also looked at in these G20 countries. If you take Africa, for example, you count 20% of the banks are there, but they only count for 1% of the total balance sheet. That shows, first of all, that are rather too small, but also the potential they have in contributing in the development of those countries. So why I'm saying that? Because often we also see in this discussion where we complain about, you know, how we mobilize private capital, how we mobilize concessional funding in those countries. And often we forget that you have those national development banks that know better how to invest in their own country because they are doing the projects. They take the risk every day. So is it a question of more money or, you know, having the right flows and having more quality money, actually? Because every year we are talking about 2.5 trillion of, you know, combined commitment every year those banks are bringing in
no, but you're saying, yeah, like, this is music to my ears because everyone, I feel like, is always asking, we need more money. We need more money. Yeah. You walk around everywhere this week and all you hear is, we're going to need however many trillions of dollars to solve the climate crisis. The money's not there. It's not going to be there politically. It's not there. It's about spending the money differently.
Exactly. I mean, just it's a question of mandate as well, because at some point, those development banks, some of them are doing, you know, good job in their countries. And I can name some examples where the mandate from the state is rather, you know, pretty clear. So you will focus on helping decarbonating the, you know, in Rwanda, for example. We have seen it with the National Development Bank of Rwanda. But at some point, if you just take a mandate focusing at the global level on saying, okay, let's try to put 20% of all the commitments we bring every year on financing climate, it's 500 billion. And we are talking about, you know, solving this 100 billion issue. So, okay, there is probably some additional stuff because they don't have all the same size. But that's my point. Helping those national development bank in preparing the projects in their country, helping them by, you know, moving these concessional funds where they can also have access. I think it is a way to, you know, fund the unfundable and get the projects done. And if we want to incentivize the private sector as well, at some point we should, you know, just stop preparing projects from Paris, Brussels, Washington, et cetera, et cetera. At some point, that's where I agree also on intermediaries, but which intermediary you are taking, you know? And I can just mention one example on you know, and it sounds a lot with what Fanny was mentioning on helping, you know, the small entrepreneurs. There is this project, actually it was in Senegal, where the government, you know, was, you know, a bit upset on why the banks don't finance the small and the youth and the girl, the ladies that are in the markets, etc., etc. At some point, they put their, you know, the government budget on the table, took a loan, founded their own development bank, which was not a bank actually, it was a government agency, and they were putting a loan in the market directly. Somehow, sometime by helping the private banks, you know, de-risking them and saying, okay, we'll put the guarantee. And sometime just by, you know, putting direct money throughout the market and with day-to-day loans. They went from 17%, like 13% a day to 3%. And banks were complaining at first. And then they put their own balance sheet on mobilizing the government money and expending it.
So this is the most common criticism of all the things that I write here about from people is well, you know, what about additionality? You're going to spook the local market. I would hear the same thing when I was at DFC and there was one transaction.
Oh, it's a question of incentive. I mean,
if, well, you don't... if the money is not going there at all, and you have to remember why you're doing the loans in the first place. So there was a deal that had to do with giving people mortgages. And risk was getting passed on to the borrowers. Said, well, why are we doing this deal? Your reason you're doing the deal is you're helping these women get access to mortgages so that they then now have collateral and then they repay it. And then people can say, hey, they've got a credit history and they've got collateral. And now they can go to the local bank and get a loan at a lower rate. Right. So that makes, and then the response is, well, you're going to distort the local market. And my response was, I can ask this to anybody in this room. If the city of Washington, D.C. offered a subsidized interest rate to first time home buyers in Washington, D.C., is there anybody in this room that would object to that and say, hey, you're distorting the local market? Like, you're not taking, and maybe sometimes what you need to do is there's a little bit of monopolies going on. And you're saying to the local banks, if you're not doing this, we're going to do it.
But the problem is at some point is taxpayers' money. You cannot do it all the time.
Right.
You have to structure a market. I mean, what public development bank do, we are supposed to fix market failures. It's not up to us to create one. I agree on that.
Right.
And it's also a way to segment, I mean, to create segmentation on also where the money goes to create opportunities for business. I'm just going to mention one example I did myself. Actually, I was working on the French overseas islands. So it's really sometime, you know, challenging areas, even though you are in the France. And we were developing this program, you know, on greening the energy sector. So helping investors to get into the power plants, you know, and at some point banks wouldn't do it. So you had the development bank, you know, investing with private investors. And we started the first program. So the government would also make subsidies on buying, you know, the offset in product at higher price. When we run like 3 to 4 years and people see this business model was working, mm-hmm. private banks come in and buy us out. I mean, we structured on all our deals. Yeah. I mean, I was happy because at some point you created the incentive for the market.
That's what IDB is doing to some degree right now also, trying to, you know, they're more aggressively saying we're going to get out of transactions at some point. Colin, I'm turning to you next after.
Hey.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. No, we're trying to do that. Yeah, because we want to get out of the game. No, we want to get into these things. One thing we talking about what you're saying and the goal is we work a lot with gig economy workers, no? And let's say that finance is not just the goal, it's also a mean to bring other services, no? So how can we use finance, like you say about mortgages, to bring services of insurance, of health, of pension, no? Is this a way of seeing finance not just as the only way we want to achieve, the only KPI, but really bringing other things to the table? Sorry, I bring in questions only, not answers, no? But this is a way of us to face...
Well, we're going to get to the part of the solutions. So I'm going to ask you, because this is, I think people are tired of hearing from me in my blogs, my list, like here are 10 things we need to do. I'm going to ask you to come up with some of the things that we need to do.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, but all right, I'm going to... Are you still going or can I turn to Colin for a second? All right. So Colin, you have been... Oh, go ahead, Laura. You want to say
really
go for it.
Say
go for it.
If that's okay.
No, I don't want to...
I'm taking you up on your provocateur.
Yeah, please do. Interrupt. Go ahead.
So one thing that you're that's coming to mind as I'm hearing you sort of frame some of the challenges or some of the opportunities that may or may not be overlooked with some of the way that the DFIs or PDBs may be operating is the following. So set aside just for a moment, because there is a conversation around the type of capital that we have access to.
Right, and that's what I'm going to get into with Colin in a second.
But I do want to emphasize the point that there's something very different, like we have to understand or we have to appreciate, I think, that even in the cases like that you're saying, we're going to give a subsidized loan for this, it has to be a bridge to somewhere.
Yeah, of course.
Because otherwise, like if something that's relying on a permanent subsidy, then that's not actually really a solution. Because if there's not an underlying viable business proposition that might need a little help in the beginning, call it blended finance, call it whatever you want, but it has to be a bridge to somewhere, because that's where the sustainability, not just green and climate, but that's where the sustainability of jobs are going to come, right? Mm-hmm. And if there's a business that's reliant on subsidies forever, that's not going to be a long-term source of stable jobs to provide income to support economic growth. So I like a lot of what you're saying in terms of having access to different types of capital to be able to make those decisions, but we have to underpin that with, they have to be commercially informed, taking risk, but informed risk decisions.
I'll take it a step further. So you're going to be surprised to hear me say this, but my view is that every loan that comes out of a DFI should be priced as high as possible to achieve the maximum amount of development impact. But the key is what's the development impact you're going to be achieving? It should be priced for the development impact and what that outcome is going to be. And part of the development impact is sustainability, right? Like, you don't want to distort the market and make it so that they're always dependent on a subsidized, you know, some sort of subsidy. If you come to the conclusion, this is going to be, we're not going to achieve long-term development impact here by giving this subsidized loan. There's no hope for this business. You shouldn't do it. Right. So
for that underpinning of the commercial viability is.
And Hans Peters here, from, most of you know Hans Peter. He and I have these types of debates all the time. So I always say these extreme things, like, let's say I want to give all this money away and destroy additionality. And he knows that I don't really believe that, but he keeps me honest on this stuff. So I agree with you 100%. And I invite you to speak and rebut at any point, Hans Peter, as well. Hans Peter is our deputy CEO in London. So, all right, Colin, over to you. You and I have had some heated discussions about this. Good ones, I thought. I think I've learned a lot from you. You've been an absolute leader on the Africa Resilience Investment Accelerated, REON. I remember when you first came to me when I was at DFC, hey, will you guys support this effort to, you know, work in fragile countries? And, you know, we were able to sell it, and I love where it's gone. But we've also had the discussion about and recognizing that DFC is different from every other DFI, and that when DFC was created, suddenly there was no requirement. Like, DFC doesn't borrow money from capital markets. It gets an appropriation from Congress every year. It just needs to be responsible with its money, right? And no one questions that. But BII and others, you have to borrow money from capital markets. You have shareholders who invest. You've got to earn a return. You have to be at capital preservation plus a few percentage points. So it's two different questions. So why don't we talk about ARIA first, and then let's all move to the question of, in the perfect world, if you didn't have to be at capital preservation levels, what would you do differently and how do we get there? So let's start with the ARIA discussion and how you've been successful with fragile.
Great, Andy. I mean, let me start out by contextualizing this. So there are a lot of underserved borrowers in the world, sadly. I mean, Lori could speak about women and the 2X challenge. I'm going to speak about SMEs in low-income countries, okay? Because as Andy says, that's what I care about. Why do I care about that? Because I think that is the last unsolved problem of development finance. And if we are going to go out of business, we're going to have to crack that job in order to go out of business, all right? Now we've tried a lot of things.
This is a great panel of people. So.
I'm going to tell you something. I don't know the answer, all right? What I do know two things. I do know a lot of things that don't work because we've been trying them for about 40 years. The other thing I know, and I am sure of, is there is no silver bullet. The development community loves silver bullets. There's no silver bullet. That means that the answer is going to be a sort of an accumulation of marginal efforts, which over time somehow erode this problem. So with that context, I'm going to give you, I thought I would give you three ideas that we're testing as potential answers. And the first one is ARIA. ARIA was launched in 2021 as a collaborative platform for IFIs and DFIs to think about fragile and conflict states in low-income countries. It is intentionally experimental because we don't know the answer, all right? So, but what does it try and do? It tries to find investments in these countries. It tries to coordinate private sector efforts between donors and DFIs, and it advocates for reform. It does this in a small selection of countries. You can't do all things in all places. And those countries are Benin, DRC, Ethiopia, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. It has been modestly successful. Let us tell us
what's worked, what hasn't worked.
First of all, many of us believed there are no investment opportunities in low-income countries. That has been proven wrong. So ARIA has identified probably 100 potential investments just in those countries. 8 of them, I think, at the moment are deep in the process of being approved as investments by DFIs. There are investments there. Well, second thing, if DFIs are...
How do you find the investments?
You're just not going to let me get into a flow, are you, Andy?
No. It's warm in here too, so it's making me...
I mean, it's hard. There's no substitution for taking investment professionals and sending them to these countries. And that's what ARIA does. It takes investment teams, takes them to a country for a week and arranges a program where they go around and they try and see as many potential companies as possible. That's the only way that you do it. You can't do it sitting in London, Washington, D.C., or in Montreal. You have to go out and do that. And we'll talk about some of the problems with that because it's damned expensive. But that's the only way it gets done. So I talked a little bit about reform. And so modest success. But let's not, problem is far from solved. Another approach, if I can go, is something we call growth investment partners. And I'm going to make my observation. One, I'm a huge fan of intermediation. BII, I think, still is the largest LP in Africa. Okay, so love the intermediation. However, on this one,
so I'm going to sit for one second. I want everyone to think about how do we do intermediation better in the perfect world. So keep going.
And I'm
going to
tell you now.
Okay, good.
Because I side with Andy on this. I think in low-income countries, intermediation fails. We've tried that. We tried the banks, they failed. We tried funds, trust me, they failed. Okay. So this is an attempt at an intermediation that works. And what it is this: it recognizes you can't do equity, you need to do debt. We can come back and explain why that is. You can't do debt in a normal way in a low-income country. What SMEs need is they need far more flexibility, they need far longer repayments. They can't post collateral. So what this platform does, by platform, I mean that we created a business, okay? And the business went out and hired a CEO and it hired investment professionals to go on the ground we've done this in Ghana and Zambia. Why? Because you're absolutely right. Intermediation only works if people are in the country, can't do it from London, can't do it from Washington, D.C. These people have the authority to negotiate local currency loans to SMEs that look to the future potential revenue of the business rather than relying on collateral, all right? Well, it may work, it may not work. It may end up on the long list of failures in low-income countries, but we're going to give it a shot, all right?
But let me say something about that, and this is why I think this is okay. USAID has a budget of $35 billion a year that it gives away. I mean, not just gives it away. It goes to contracts and grants. It's aimed towards doing development. A lot of it fails, and that's okay. That's what development's all about. But you guys are development institutions. You know, I often will tell this story, and my colleagues are probably tired of me. You all have heard me say this. So when we're doing Power Africa, if I tell you the story that we helped collectively this partnership with everybody, you know, DFIs, you know, USAID, everyone helped 120 power projects worth $20 billion reach financial close, and it only cost the U.S. taxpayer $500 million to do that. And everyone oohs and ahs, and I go down and I brief Capitol Hill on this, like, wow, that's incredible leverage. You got $40 of investment for every dollar that we spent, gave to USAID. But if Agnes were to go down to the Hill and say, DFC financed 120 power projects worth $20 billion and it lost $500 million in that portfolio, everyone would say, why did you lose that money? But it's the exact same thing. And so it's money, development money that has been spent. And this is why thinking through, like, How do we get to the point where you explain this to the stakeholders and others that if only you had more money to do the types of deals that you need to do, not for all of them, not in middle income countries. Yeah. Price them as high as you possibly can to have the development impact that you want to have. But in some places like low income countries, you're going to need to maybe price them lower. You know, so anyone, go ahead, Adama.
Just sorry, Andy, do you know how many billions on those you have mentioned goes to the businesses in those countries?
How many billions of what?
Of the budget you mentioned of you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a whole side issue. We can do a separate panel about that.
I mean,
yeah,
that's my point. I mean, actually, the fact that we are speaking about development somehow, it links on the, your first question on the instruments. If you took a, I mean, I'm just going to give two examples, and one of them is in the US. USAID issued, I mean, lately, the fact to say, okay, we will push a number, you know, on having 30% of our commitments to be implemented through local procurement.
Yes, 25%.
And then a few days after, come out to say, okay, no, finally, not 30%, but 25%, right? And at some point, we asked ourselves, for some development banks, and I'm going to take the example from AFD, and our CEO was like, okay, how much are we doing? Because if people start, you know, reviewing their numbers, and we are on more than 90%, because you are doing, in one side, you're doing loan, and when you give the loan to the country, you are not telling him who will spend that loan. I mean, they have their own procurement procedures, then they can issue and have local procurement. If you use the grant and somehow you didn't disconnect the how you implement the grant, you have temptation to have SMEs or, you know, companies from your country based in Washington or wherever, implementing it in DRC or, you know, in other country. And the money stays in US. So that's typically one
thing. This goes to the point that I was making, that to really do, to support the public development banks, people don't talk about financing when they talk about the localization discussion. For anyone to say something.
Yeah, I wanted to use two examples, which I think you're asking what has worked. So I give two examples with my other hat. One is FSD Africa, single shareholder, UK government. So DFID puts the shareholding capital. You have two components. One is purely policy work, market creation, supporting the development of new markets that you actually need in the financial sector in particular. So the capital markets, carbon markets, all those really hard to do things.
That's with ODA, grant money.
That's done by FSD Africa. And then you have FSD Africa Investment that actually then takes the risk to prove that the private sector can actually do it. So you're working with two legs.
And making sure there's additionality. Exactly. They're not going to go into something that a private. Exactly.
And you can see now, looking at the evolution of this model, the FSDA Africa investment is now growing and has a handover point then to BII. So this gives you a very nice array of how tax dollars can be used to invest in a way that creates markets, puts this, the subsidies where they ought to go, but doesn't distort the markets because it uses another arm to do the early testing, piloting, and then it can be scaled up by another entity, in this case, BII. The other one is a model which the Nordic countries did with the SADC countries, is my other hat, which is NORSAD. 33 years ago, the Nordic countries came up, put capital hand in hand with the SADC countries to create a debt facility, to issue debt to commercial entities that otherwise could not find debt in the market. They put equity into that company. And then a few years ago, they got the company to now leverage by borrowing from commercial entities and then lending to the commercial entities because you had that cushion of equity to sustain that. So it acted like an intermediary. Now, of course, that was going very well until the current very high interest rate environments and the currency risks Africa is facing and so on. So there are a bit of challenges with this model for that from that point of view. But those DFIs have stuck there for 33 years with this model to prove that private debt actually works in Africa. In the SADC countries, which include countries like Zimbabwe, Zambia.
This was equity 33 years ago that they put it.
They put equity, and now the company is leveraging that equity by getting debt through the market.
So Agnes, DFC, well, BII also, a bunch of you have equity authority. So is that something that it would equity investments in some of these intermediaries, how would that, in your viewpoint, be different from low-cost loans or regular loans that you give? Do you have any thoughts about that? Is equity
just,
a better
tool? Yeah, not just the intermediaries, but the businesses as well. Right?
Well, no, but I mean, want to talk about the intermediaries specifically, because in her case, you're talking about like banks. So right. Businesses, obviously equity, that's a separate discussion. I'm just curious.
So of course, I mean, equity provides you with a lot more flexibility, right? To really have products because it's longer-term capital. So you can actually then... you can leverage that, you can get more money, but also you can use equity to then deliver different kinds of products that might be some sort of quasi debt and equity instruments, which, so it does give you a lot of flexibility. I mean, we are actually looking into how to support local regional development institutions and banks with equity capital because, or equity-like capital, because they all, what I think we haven't discussed here is a lot of these intermediaries, especially the local development banks, they really need tier two capital at this point, right? To shore up their own balance sheet. So I think this conversation becomes really important. How do you provide more equity-like capital to those intermediaries so that they can do more?
So when you're saying equity-like capital, it's still a debt instrument, but it's dressed up to look like equity, which yeah. OPEC did.
Yeah, I agree. So, yeah. And how we can provide a skin in the game to all the levels in a way that is scalable, no? Because it's not just about wanting to get out of the game, no? It's if we do it right, we won't get access to more funding necessarily, no? Or the intermediaries. So how we really make a scheme in which there is a skin in the game and something to win in every level in an equity-like, which is not easy, honestly, because
right.
If DFC has a lot of funding, the better you do, you are not going to get more money, no? If I'm not wrong, no? Will you?
Will DFC get more money if it doesn't do well?
No, if they do a good job in SME finance, no? If you get the good, you know, if you get SME to grow, will you get more money, more funding from the government?
So that's the, it depends. I don't think so. I think that, well, go ahead, Agnes.
I mean, it depends, right? It's not, as Andy was saying, we're funded very differently.
Yeah.
I think what we, the way we would grow is if we deliver really great development results, right? And if that means more SME financing, more job creation, then yes, I mean, we were established with kind of a dual purpose in mind. One is development impact, and the other one is foreign policy, support US foreign policy. So I think as long as we could show results, those are our kind of goalposts. As long as we can show those results, I mean, we should be able to grow even further, yeah.
Laura, you've had your hand on your mic.
Yeah, no, just I wanted to underscore, I think Fannie made some really good points. One is that it's an ecosystem approach, right? And you talked about sort of that early upstream, like, so not losing sight of the ecosystem, because the financing, the commercially based financing is only going to be so successful when kind of all the other upstream stuff is done. The importance of putting the building blocks together across that ecosystem. And that relates to the intentionality of each dollar spent, right? So the intentionality behind grant money to support legal, regulatory, or grant money to support sort of business development, concessional finance to support early demonstration projects that will then lead to commercial finance. So each one of those has a different strategy behind it, has a different sort of thesis behind it, if you will, but being very intentional about what each dollar, whether it's sort of from each dollar from the ODA budget, whether it's for a commercial.
Well, I'm going to turn to your colleagues, your Canadian colleagues who are here, if that's all right with you, because Global Affairs Canada has Innovative Finance, which has somewhat of a different mandate from FinDev Canada, but you work with one another. And I'm going to grab your microphone. Thank you. Just to see, you know, you do have these different pieces. So we've got Genevieve Brown and Cam Doe here. So Genevieve, you and I have had a lot of conversations about this. And so the criticism that I often give is that when you think about the aid world, and I said USAID gives away, let's say, or grants or contracts out $35 billion or so. There's like someone said yesterday, there's $150 billion of ODA right now a year. That might not be the right number, but it's a limited amount of ODA. And then you've got the finance agencies that are over here who are at capital preservation plus a few percentage points. But you have all this space in between where if you had could shift some of this ODA to development finance agent institutions, could they get to the point where they don't have to earn 100% and you could make up that shortfall? And I'm going to have Colin to talk about this as well. So I threw this idea out to him a long time ago. I don't know if he has had time to stew on it at all, but I just want to invite any insights or thoughts that you might have, Genevieve, on this thought of the role of innovate, you know, what you all have been doing.
Sure. Thanks. We've been in a process of rethinking the program over the last 18 months, and it's been really interesting. And I think this conversation is very illustrative of a lot of the thinking that's been going into this, because as a donor, we have the ability to do a lot of what has been talked about today, but what is the particular value added of our money in the role that we can play, given that we are not structured to be self-sustaining? We do, of course, we have to be responsible with taxpayer monies, but the way we can define that can look very differently. I think this is an opportunity with what we've been learning in blended finance to think about this differently, where we can start to push things down in the investment stack more, because things that we've talked about in terms of how are we defining risk, but are we quantifying the risk of not taking enough risk, right? What does that translate into? Are we calculating what it means to not take on those additional opportunities to be able to get to the impact that we're trying to, because all of us are driven by impact. So how do we open up that space when we know that we haven't been mobilizing the money? We know we haven't been taking enough risk. We know that these things in the lessons that we have today of the last few years. So these are the questions that we're asking ourselves. What can we as a donor play in these structures and these investment opportunities that'll allow us to get closer? Because even in the question of intermediaries, it is about which intermediaries and what they're doing in different circumstances. So it's been just interesting hearing all the different interventions, because we obviously also work through intermediaries. We're not an implementer ourselves, but what does it mean to work with an intermediary that is just pushing their costs onto their borrowers? That's not successful. That might be necessary, but how do we take on some of that risk a little bit more? How can we pay
how
for that?
Work together.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask this.
And local currencies too, right, Andy?
Yeah, we didn't even get into local currency financing. Yeah. That's a whole separate issue, but that's something that I'm constantly going about. All right. So this is going to be for Colin and Lori, right? It's suddenly, I'd like to go give it to Colin. That's fine. So suddenly FCDO said, hey, Colin, we're going to give you an extra £500 million a year as ODA for BII to really make a difference. What are you going to do with that money? You can say it's never going to happen. But
No. That's I have an answer to that. But ask me the first question,
okay,
which is, what if you said that we only had to return 90%?
Yeah, yeah. What would you do?
Because I think we'd have this conversation many times, but I think it's worth explaining why this is a clever question, which Andy has made. Here's the first. It comes from the following recognition, that if you look at a chart of return, you have a huge number of institutions clustered between 102% return on capital and 120% return on capital. And in that relatively small band, you have everything from BlackRock and Goldman Sachs to impact investors, the IFC, and all of us up here. And that's a really narrow band. At the bottom, you have grants, which lose 100% of their capital. And in between, you have an enormous vacuum. And so Andy's question really is, why is there a vacuum? I mean, that makes no sense. Surely it should all be populated. You should have like everything from a 100% loss to a 50% loss. And okay. But there is a reason why this operates. And it's worth saying this, which is DFIs need to make a profit. All right. And we have to be honest about that. Or more specifically, they need to make a profit in order to do some of the things that are subjects to other ODI events. Mobilization. If we are losing money every year, we are not a commercial investor. We are not credible. There's no way that we can mobilize commercial capital if we essentially lose, money every single year. Second point is, many companies would not take the money from us. It's the reciprocal of the question you asked over here about why DFIs won't give money to businesses that took grants. Some of those companies won't take an investment from us if we're losing money, because then we're a grant organization, okay? So a lot of things fail along the way, which is why you cleverly restructured your question to not say what happens if you lose, you know.
Well, I don't 10%. Call it losing. I'm saying, let's say that you went into a transaction.
But now you just want to give me extra money, all right?
No, what I'm saying is,
in order to,
if somebody needs local currency financing, you're a development institution, and you know that over the last 20 years, the Ghanaian cedi has lost 70% of its value. Bianca's here. She can correct me on whatever the number is of its value against the US dollar. But you go into it saying, we are going to take on the first $10 million of that anticipated currency loss. And we're going to give you a loan, and we are taking that hit. But you as BII, you can't do that because you don't have the ODA to take on that hit. But if you were to put it on a chart, you'd see, all right, we're only earning back 95%. Okay, so, so I'm not saying
let me tell you
bad deals. I never said that.
Agree. No, okay. I agree. Yeah. So let me tell you now how I would spend your $500 million.
All
thank you very much. I understand you brought
pleasure.
I understand you brought a checkbook. So, okay. Half of it I would use to offset expected losses in investments in low-income countries. Those losses may happen in many ways. They may happen because of depreciation. They may happen because the businesses are too risky. They may happen because we actually have to do some short-term gap financing to make things. Companies can come up with a lot of ways to lose money. So half of your $500 million I would use to cover those losses, so that my investments in low-income countries are sheltered from losses.
Make more investments in low-income countries?
Well, yes, because at the moment, I can't lose any money in low-income countries. And another observation, we've looked at the data of our investing in low-income countries over years. We lose money, okay? It's not a question about not making returns. We lose money. We lose about 5%, okay? But you lose money.
5% on that portfolio in low-income countries.
Yeah.
Well, that's not terrible. All right, but go ahead.
Well, yeah.
So there you are. You're at your 95% return.
Well, okay, again, remember, we have to be profitable. So losing 5%, you know.
But if you had the ODA to do that, but go ahead.
This is over time, overall, you know, this is including project finance where we never lose money. So take it with a grain of salt. I still have $250 million. I would spend it in two ways. Half of that I would spend on the supplemental expenses that we face in making investments in low-income countries, because this is a piece no one really talks about. It's not just that we lose money. It's that doing the due diligence, understanding these, is fiendishly expensive in these countries. So I would take $250 million to do that, leaves me with $250 million, which I will spend on vast amounts of technical assistance to these businesses to try and get them into a place that they both satisfy at least their own national law, that they understand how to expand their business so that they have the capacity to deal with some of the extraordinary challenges in this business. If you're in a giving mood, I would ask you.
I'm going to give some to Lori too.
If you're in a giving mood, I would ask for one more thing, which is, let me be a little bit more flexible about all of the ESG requirements in low-income countries, okay? Especially when I'm talking about SMEs. Let me take a more principled approach. National laws, do no harm, constant improvement, but free me from the vast ESG requirements designed for project finance projects in Brazil. So that would be my last ask.
So I realize we're at time. Lori, did he answer the question the similar way that you would have answered that?
I think you did a really great job, Colin. So congratulations. But what I think is really important about what Colin outlined is that it's not just like, you know, either we can lose money or don't have to repay money, but there has to be a strategy behind how you're going to use the money. Otherwise it's mushy, it's fuzzy.
Yes.
And it leads to credibility issues in the market and for the markets that we're trying to serve and for the counterparties.
Would you do a lot more if you had a lot of ODA to work on your transactions?
Certainly, if there was more concessional financing available, more technical assistance available, without a doubt. However, let's not lose sight of the fact that there are commercially viable opportunities that we should still maximize.
Of course.
So it's about building balance.
We are in agreement on that. I said, this is focusing on the hard stuff, Hans-Peter. This is the discussion on the hard stuff. Keep doing all the other stuff in middle income countries.
Yes.
Access
to different products would be super helpful.
Because we're out of time, raise your hand. Did their answer satisfy? Fanny, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, the last word. Go ahead.
I just wanted to give a quick example of how DFIs came in to support something like that. African Risk Capacity Limited, private insurance for disaster risk to farmers, directly to farmers. The UK and Germany put 100 million, say, pay us back in 30 years, just the 100 million, no return, just what we put in. African countries then came in and put in their capital, not as much, of course, because they're poorer. But they put together then an entity which is based in Bermuda, giving private insurance to countries that suffer disaster risk. So Senegal got 17 million when they had a drought. Now that model has been used now for the post-pandemic risks. So it proved that it's actually the right approach because you're building long-term insurance knowledge, long-term insurance markets, and you're doing that with DFI money at risk to be repaid, but over 30 years. So longer time horizon for repayment. I think if you could do more of that, you could see a lot of private sector solutions come in these very difficult markets.
Great, thanks. Adama, you're holding your mic.
Just one minute. Last point.
Yeah. We're over time. So
I mean, even shorter. On the hard part, I mean, the things that we don't often see financing either directly or intermediaries, somehow I think we should also put ourselves as intermediaries. And I've seen lately a big push on financing, you know, culture, sport, food development projects, right? So if you have these big, you know, infrastructure projects, you can still have a small portion on how you imagine, you know, helping local artists, you know, to also benefit from the projects you are making. And there's several people that have, you know, small amount of money here and there, and they don't have these reach and capacity to access those people and those, you know, populations on the ground. So that's where, as DFIs, we should also think of when we structure our project to have a component on sports and development. And even FIFA, lately, they have $1 billion, they want to spend on, you know, buying balls and giving it to people. So we just raised our hand and was like, we have better idea, probably. We can discuss that and structure a way to put what that $100 billion on the projects we have in the ground, and that can be useful to the youth, the women, and all the artists and, you know, all the margin people you was mentioning. So thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. I want to thank the panelists. I want to really thank you, because even for those of you who know me and you knew what you were walking into, you still agreed to be on this panel. And it was just a great discussion. I hope everyone felt like you were sitting in the room. I wish we had more time to take questions from the floor, but sitting in the room and having some of the really difficult discussions that we all have with one another, because you have a panel of people who genuinely care about trying to solve these issues and are always trying to think outside of the box, reflect honestly about what's working, what's not working, and just know that this is an ongoing conversation. It's something that ODI cares deeply about. So this just gives you a little glimpse into the issues that we need to tackle. And we hope that we as ODI will continue to provide opportunities for you all to participate in these types of discussions and to really put the ideas out there about how we could do what all of us set out to do when we took the jobs that we took, was really to try to figure out how to help the countries and the people who really need financing the most. So thank you.